From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. After almost 2 weeks of tension over the death of Freddie Gray, Baltimore erupted on Monday, the day of Gray's funeral. Streets boiling with angry youth and keyed-up police. Riot, rock-throwing, looting, fire, billy clubs, pepper spray. Maryland's governor has declared a state of emergency and brought in the National Guard. A citywide curfew is now in place, and there is much to be resolved. This hour on Point, anger, violence, race, and police in Baltimore. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see playing out right now in the streets of Baltimore? Could it come to your town? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. The sound right there of Baltimore last night, sirens, helicopter, curfew on now. Yesterday, Marquetta Hurd talked about why tensions with police are high in Baltimore.
It's sad. They said my sons have actually been victims of the police beating them up. And this is what they say: if I gotta chase you, I'm a up. And that's been a motto from Western District 40 years.
But Freddie Gray's own mother, Gloria Darden, spoke out saying, don't tear the city up.
Don't tear up the whole city, man. Guess for him, it's wrong.
Baltimore Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake condemned the violence in her city.
It is idiotic to think that by destroying your city that you're going to make life better for anybody.
And Governor Larry Hogan of Maryland called out the National Guard.
This order deploys the Maryland National Guard in order to help restore order and to end the unrest that we witnessed.
We want to hear Baltimore voices today and yours. We'll hear in a moment from Jamal Bryant, pastor at the Empowerment Temple, who gave the eulogy at Freddie Gray's funeral yesterday. Joining me first from Baltimore is Erica Green, reporter for the Baltimore Sun. She's at Mondawan Mall, where yesterday's uproar began. Erica Green, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
And with us from Baltimore, Baltimore City Councilman Carl Stokes represents the city's 12th district, neighbors the area in turmoil right now. Councilman Stokes, thank you for joining us today.
Of course, Tom.
And from Baltimore, Natasha Pratt-Harris is with us, professor of criminal justice and sociology at Morgan State University in Baltimore. She took her children into the city streets of protest over the weekend to let them see the passion there. Natasha Pratt-Harris, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Why did you take your children into the streets of Baltimore on Saturday?
I took them to every event that engages them in a discussion about our race, our history, and the criminal justice system. I'm a criminologist. My children see me engaging all the time academically and socially, culturally. So this is a norm for me. I, in fact, took my middle daughter to the Gen 6 rallies. She was birthed knowing that reality. And today they know wholeheartedly what the problems are, and they are as concerned about what happened in Baltimore 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago with Freddie, that as concerned as they are with what happened overnight. So they are well engaged. They have to be because mom's a criminologist.
Councilman Stokes, the mayor says what's going on right now is idiotic. What do you say?
I think that that language, which is, in my opinion, somewhat over the top, doesn't reflect the leadership we need, the leadership that has taken us to the not just to the brink, but over the brink in terms of what has been taking place in our town and our city, a city that is great, a city that is overwhelmingly supportive, frankly, of police, but also wants very much justice.
Here's the mayor yesterday saying that Baltimore's peaceful protests earlier should not have turned violent, and she, controversial here, but not everybody disagrees, used the word thugs here.
It is very clear there is a difference between what we saw over the past week with the peaceful protests, and the difference between those protests and the thugs who only want to incite violence and destroy our city.
Erica Green with the Baltimore Sun, what happened yesterday to turn this from more peaceful protests that we had seen for days after the video came out of Freddie Gray's last hours into this eruption in the streets? How did it begin, Erica? What happened here?
It began at a large transportation hub for high school students over at Mondawmin Mall. I think some 4,000 to 5,000 students, intersect there at some point after school to get to their homes across the city.
They have to. This is where they go to get to school and to get back home. It's the transport hub, huh?
It is a major transportation hub for several high schools in the city. And there was a social media posting that advertised an event called a purge that was to begin at 3 p.m. right around dismissal time. We followed up on that. We went over. I got there around 3:20. When I got there, students had definitely started to engage in some behavior that that definitely set things kind of in motion. I walked into hurling bricks and rocks, a crowd had swelled by that point. I also walked into a situation where police were in riot gear. I believe they had been there waiting for dismissal in anticipation of this event. So, the two were definitely facing off by the time I got there. And really, it just escalated from there. The police started to push the crowds back. Crowds started to swell. More police reinforcements showed up, and they started to go into the neighborhoods from there. Officers began being injured. Students started to get arrested. The neighborhood started to come out, and it was just, an all-out face-off. And it really kind of, as that started to push into some side streets, it started to be pushed downtown.
Here's Baltimore Police Commissioner Anthony Batts saying the violence is the wrong solution.
This is not protesting. This is not your First Amendment rights. This is just criminal acts doing damage to a community that is challenged in some ways that do not need this and do not need to be harmed in a way that we have today.
Natasha Pratt-Harris, you're our criminal justice professor here. The policing itself has been at the heart of this whole focus on Baltimore. What about the policing in the last 24 hours and what's erupted here?
The policing is just showcasing the problems that we've already had. Our police officers, our department, the way we do policing, the mandates that the police are getting from their superiors, doesn't tell them to talk to our children. They had a great opportunity considering the purge announcement that I actually became aware of because my own children told me about it early in the morning yesterday. They had a great opportunity to engage with our children in the schools, much like we handle situations when there is threats of terror and we lock down our schools. We could have very well locked down our schools. We could have engaged with students using the administrators and principals and teachers and police officers who are around to engage to make sure that they are safe, number one, and to also make sure there was no eruption of violence outside of our schools. So we failed our students today. We failed our students this week. What we can do at this point is address the problem where we're not engaging with communities, we're definitely not engaging with our children, and do something different, because what we do does not work. When we approach children with riot gear, children who may or may not have an agenda upon leaving a bus station, you are going to incite some type of disorder, and that's exactly what happened in the past 24 hours.
15 police officers injured, we're told. Here's Police Commissioner Carol D'Souza saying more than a dozen injured anyway.
What we know right now, just preliminarily, is that objects, bricks, bottles, I'm not sure exactly specifically what it was, but it was flying debris that caused the injuries.
And there was a lot flying, rocks and bricks and cinder block, and we had fire before it was over here. Early this morning, though, Anaya Mays talked with NPR standing on a Baltimore street alone in front of a line of police officers in riot gear.
I see no shame in being violent. Be heard.
Baltimore City Councilman Carl Stokes, you hear that Baltimore residents say, I see no shame in being violent to be heard. Are you sympathetic with that or with the mayor's view that this is just tearing up what's taken decades to build?
this has taken decades to build up. This is a culmination. This is not a single incident. The killing of the homicide of Freddie Gray was not a single incident. It was something that happens all the time in our city in terms of brutality, killing of black males by a few police officers. It's not the greater majority. The neglect of children and their needs over the years. This what happened yesterday was lawlessness. It was individuals taking advantage of a true cry for justice. There is no doubt about that. But it was bred, is bred, about how we have mistreated so many young people in the communities of Baltimore City.
Erica Green, your newspaper, the Baltimore Sun, published big work last fall. Sun investigates the headline, Undue Force, and they're talking about the Baltimore police chronicling a long record of broken bones, jaws, noses, arm, legs, ankle, head trauma, organ failure, death during questionable arrests. Do you see justifiable complaint in the streets, given all that, Erica?
You know, we have. I mean, my colleague Mark Puente did a fantastic job of documenting years' worth of complaints and brutality cases that, you know, what struck me about that series is that he showed that in the end, many of those arrests were unjustified. And, you know, I will say that out on the street yesterday, you know, I talked to students. I, of course, couldn't get quotes and their names, but I said, what is this about? You know, I heard everything from justice for Freddie to they need to stop killing us to, you know, just, you know, more expletives or how they feel about the police in general. But, you know, the kids were very, very angry, and it came from somewhere. You could tell it was deep-rooted, for sure. So, you know, I agree with everyone that this has been obviously, you know, building up over time. A lot of the kids were from the neighborhood, and it seems that, you know, this was just a continuation of some of the interactions they had with police before. You know, I also do believe that there were people who kind of came to the situation with maybe other intentions because there was a melee of sorts. But you know, there is a relationship, a broken relationship in the city that the Sun has documented and that we, I think, are seeing explode now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Baltimore in a state of emergency. Erica Green is with us from the Baltimore Sun. She's been right in the middle of all this. Baltimore City Councilman Carl Stokes is with us. Baltimore's Natasha Pratt-Harris. She's a professor of criminal justice at Morgan State in Baltimore. Lots of calls around the country for all of you. Tim in Lexington, Kentucky. Tim, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Yes, hi. I've been following this, and I don't understand. The mayor should work for these citizens and these children who grow up in that city, not just the people who profit from their businesses. Why hasn't the mayor put the chief of police and the commissioner, police commissioner, on notice? They have 24 hours to produce the names of the people who are responsible for Freddie's care, and they call them in together, and they either sink together or one of them, you know, or they rat out who hurt him. And if they're not willing to do that, then the people, you know, in the time frame when he was harmed, should all be fired, because if they want to stick together like wolves, then they should, you know, be, you know, pinned in like wolves.
I mean, that does sound a lot like the way alleged criminals might be handled if there was a gang crime. Councilman Stokes, what about it? It is kind of amazing that we still don't know more about how Freddie Gray died, in spite of the fact that he was with police and in police custody through that time on into the hospital. Is it worth seeing this unfold in Baltimore? Why don't the police come forward with something clearer?
Because they protect one another, and it's very unfortunate. They've had 5 press conferences to say that we're holding a press conference to be transparent. And each time it's murkier than the time before. We obviously all know in Baltimore City that Freddie Gray died in the hands of the police. There's no question about that. He died in their hands. His vertebrae was broken. It forced into his spinal cord and severed his spinal cord. We know that he was handcuffed and shackled and thrown in the back of a police van and not put into a seatbelt, so that he was tossed about all over that van. We know that legalities not aside, but we know that the inhumanity of that arrest and the ethics of or non-ethics of that arrest are very obvious to everybody. And there's no doubt that he was killed or caused to die. He was killed by the police department. That's, and I'm not a firebrand. I'm not running this up the pole for to see which way the wind is blowing.
Yep.
We know what happened, and they won't say it, and they won't say we're holding these officers accountable for the homicide of Freddie Gray. That's what people want to hear some 3 weeks later.
They're on paid leave now. Natasha Pratt-Harris, when we had this situation in North Charleston with the video of the man behind the pawn shop who the police been fired on repeatedly, Walter Scott, he died. Boom, boom, boom. They were done with that. He was out of the force. Why not here, Natasha?
In this area, we don't have the authority to fire our officers on spot. And quite honestly, we hide behind that process as so much as making swift decisions. Last week I attended a meeting with Congressman Elijah Cummings, the commissioner, and several other powers that be in the city. And that's one of the very things we discussed, that we can't move swiftly when we see these incidences because our system is set up where we in fact can't. But what we're seeing today, what we know today, is now we must change the way we do business. If an officer is acting criminally, he or she should be charged criminally. If it's noted without a doubt that, you know, an incident occurred at the hands of an officer where a person was injured or killed, then there should be swift punishment, as swift as the punishment that incurred in the case of Freddie, where he wasn't even charged, but he was definitely punished immediately upon being in police custody.
A crushed larynx, and the family says 80% of his spine severed there. At Freddie Gray's funeral yesterday, chief eulogist was Pastor Jamal Bryant in Baltimore.
No justice! No justice! No justice!
No justice, no peace. And there is no peace in Baltimore right now. Pastor Jamal Bryant, pastor of the Empowerment Temple in Baltimore, Methodist Episcopal Church there, joins us right now from Baltimore. Pastor Bryant, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, it's my privilege. Thank you.
We saw you very impassioned in that eulogy in the sanctuary at the church yesterday. Meanwhile, outside, there was no peace. Is this what you were calling for?
Absolutely not. The piece that we were saying was a disruptive system, but in a peaceable way. We've been calling for a complete revision of the penal justice system and policing in Baltimore because of excessive force, particularly in light of the Freddie Gray case. And what happened yesterday is absolutely inexcusable and doesn't line up with the movement that we've been trying to push forward.
Do you feel that the city is changing its attitudes here? Or are the young, largely men in the streets justified at this point in their anger?
I think that they have a right to be angry. I don't think they have a right to burn down a CVS or to loot through stores. Absolutely no right for lawlessness. To watch it done, respect the greatness of our city, to see what's in place before the entire world. And schools are closed today, and as a consequence, we brought high schoolers from across the city to meet at our church so that we could, in fact, help them understand what civil disobedience really means and so that they can stay focused on what it is that we're fighting and marching for.
In a press conference yesterday, Freddie Gray's stepfather, Richard Shipley, spoke out against the violence.
To see that it turned into all this violence and destruction, I am really appalled. Family, I love you, and we're supposed to be in this for justice, but is it just us?
Erica Green at the Baltimore Sun, what are you anticipating in terms of what's in the street now? How much National Guard for how long? And what about the claim that there was some gang threat against police?
We right now the city is really banding together to, you know, do cleanup efforts. I'm actually going to head over to the Empowerment Temple to talk to some high school students, given how some of their classmates were, you know, acted yesterday. And so the state of emergency is still underway. I know a curfew takes effect tonight at 10 p.m., so that's going to have to be enforced. So I do anticipate that we'll still have the level of law enforcement presence here. But today, you know, the community is really coming together to clean up, to talk, to try to heal. But, you know, things, you know, could go either way, particularly with the curfew.
The city said there had been gang threats against the police. Has that been verified?
So we did actually have a reporter out at a meeting between rival gang members yesterday who met with some clergy to call for peace. And they indicated to us that never happened. The police did send out that there was a credible threat, that gang members would be targeting officers. But gang members did dispute that claim to some of our reporters. So that's what we know about that so far.
Erica Green with the Baltimore Sun. Erica, thank you very much for joining us today. Be safe in your reporting.
Thank you.
Pastor Jamal Bryant, you've been critical of the rioters in the streets of Baltimore yesterday. What about the police and their riot gear and their policing yesterday? How did that look to you?
I think that in any other nation, when it is that people get fed up with a system and want change, they really are labeling it politically as an uprising. What we saw was an uprising that was had gone out of control. For 6 days, we had peaceful protesters, but yesterday was something that doesn't even fit the motif of what it is that we've been calling for. I want to add to your listening audience that
yes,
something really is suspicious about yesterday, and Erica alluded to it just a moment ago from the Baltimore Sun.
Mm-hmm.
The very first one is the police releasing a press release that they had intelligent information about gangs targeting police officers. Number one, what's interesting is they released that while we were in the funeral. Number two, I don't know of any law enforcement agency that does a press release about private or secret intelligence information being gained. Now, note this, within the hour, they then released about this so-called purge that was supposed to take place through the high schoolers. We have never in the history of Baltimore ever had a purge in our city. So within 1 hour, you've got two different citations from the same police department. One is about this purge, and two is about the imminent threat that's supposed to take place endangering police officers, both while we were in the funeral. Then while it is that we're at the cemetery is when everything goes into smithereens that we have not seen in this city since 1968 when they announced the killing of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. So I think that there's some other things afoot. And what she also alluded to is that last night up until the wee hours of the morning, the clergy met with the gang leaders who said they had absolutely no idea where that came from. And they had signed in our presence a peace accord to help us today walk and patrol the streets.
Pastor Bryant, we have callers for you. Lauren in Charleston, South Carolina. Lauren, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Hi. I actually grew up in Baltimore. Now I live in Charleston, and
yeah,
it's so interesting to see similar situations happening with police brutality and how differently they've been handled in the two different cities.
It sure is.
Yesterday, my husband and I, he also born and raised near Baltimore, were just heartbroken to see a city that we grew up in and love and have roots still there being really destroyed. And I guess I just had a comment too. I believe it's one of your guests. I just actually tuned in not that long ago.
Yeah.
About police coming at kids in riot gear. And, you know, nobody wants to see kids in this situation. It's terribly heartbreaking. I don't know what these kids have seen or gone through in their lives to get to the point where this is their reality. But, you know, conversely, the police, yes, they probably could engage. I believe that the schools should have been on lockdown. I don't know. Actually, I'll admit my own ignorance. I don't know whose call that is to put the schools on lockdown. I don't know if the police would have been able to do that or not.
But what you're saying, the police were right to be in riot gear if the young people are rioting.
Rioting, yeah, that's what I think. And I mean, and my heart breaks for those kids. It does. But at the same time, I don't know what choice you're left with if you want to contain some semblance of order and not let things spiral out of control more than they are.
Lauren, I'll put that to all my guests, and I appreciate your call. We're talking about Baltimore in a state of emergency. Pastor Bryant, first to you. Did the police in part provoke this by being riot ready, or was that just good policing?
I think one, and I'm very hard and critical on the police, but having led demonstrations in Ferguson, if you watch the footage, the police exercised and demonstrated incredible restraint. I think that they were very torn because at the end of the day...
You mean in Baltimore they were restrained, you're saying?
Yes, in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Because I think that they were really torn because when you look at the footage, they're really dealing with children. And so I think that they were really at an impasse on how do you respond that while they were out of order, that these are still children. They had on school uniforms. And so... It could have been a lot worse had the police not exercised a greater level of restraint.
Pastor Jamal Bryant, pastor at the Empowerment Temple in Baltimore, who gave the eulogy for Freddie Gray yesterday. Pastor Bryant, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Natasha Pratt-Harris at Morgan State in Baltimore. Lauren in South Carolina is partly responding to you. Your depiction of the police is too ready to get tough yesterday and maybe having provoked this. She says, what do you want?
Yeah, I'm thinking about our teachers who are on the front line in our public schools. They have to deal with moments when our students are engaging in a negative manner, maybe fights in the schoolhouse. We have our own police force in the in our schools, and those teachers and those officers do not report or respond to our children in our schools in riot gear. They don't have to. We have had incidences of our teachers being assaulted. They're, although painful, and we regret those, and we don't want that, they are few and far between. We, you know, made national spotlight when it comes to that. But our teachers, our principals, our police officers in our schools are not responding in riot gear. I will say that we have too much contact with law enforcement amongst our kids in Baltimore City Public Schools. We're actually addressing that via a federal mandate, which is called disproportionate minority contact. We have a DMC coordinator in Baltimore City and different jurisdictions throughout the state. But at the end of the day, our law enforcement need to engage with the community. They need to know our children. They need to understand their pains in order to do an effective job on dealing with moments of minor or major crisis. And we're in crisis mode. Our children are in pain. They are confused. Some of them are, you know, touted and labeled just clearly as criminal animals and the like. And at the end of the day, they are our children, good, bad, or indifferent.
Councilman Stokes, a lot of people around the country are looking at this and saying, what's going on here? You've got a black mayor in Baltimore. You've got a black police commissioner. You're just miles away from Washington, where we now have a black U.S. attorney general, first woman in that, and a black woman in that role, and a black president of the United States. With all of that, should there be a racial element to this? Is there an irony there, or is it deeper than those figures, Councilman?
Yes, well, we have a racist institution, and sometimes because you replace the head with a black male or black female, that doesn't change the fact that the institution itself is racist, and that culture hasn't changed. Let me tell you that 16 years ago, we used to have the police athletic leagues, that we had police running camps and mentoring and computer labs. And then Martin O'Malley, the guy who would be president now from became the mayor of Baltimore City. He decided we must have zero tolerance, and black males were arrested for no reason at all, sitting on the steps, a piece of gum being thrown on the ground. Frankly, he hired a police commissioner who said, we police are not social workers. He decided to cut out all of the police athletic leagues, the police mentoring camps, the computer labs, and said, we're tough on crime, we're not social workers. And so this, partly what we have yesterday, was born of that cultural change and the intrinsic racism of this current institution.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it, That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at WBUR.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about Baltimore in a state of emergency. Baltimore City Councilman Carl Stokes is with us, represents the 12th district in the city there. We just heard from Pastor Jamal Bryant, who gave the eulogy at Freddie Gray's funeral in Baltimore yesterday, from Erica Green, who's been out in the streets covering all the rioting, looting, fires, rock throwing, and the police response. Very, very tough. For the Baltimore Sun, Natasha Pratt-Harris is with us as well, professor of criminal justice and sociology at Morgan State University in Baltimore. Here's a little tape on Saturday. This was a nonviolent protest in Freddie Gray's neighborhood, Gilmore Homes. The Center for Emerging Media, it's a Baltimore nonprofit, interviewed one of the protesters about the community and the roots of the Freddie Gray protests.
Segregation, redlining, racial zoning, America's history. You know, you look at this public housing development here, Gilmore Homes. You know, public housing in Baltimore was originally segregated. You had black public housing, white public housing, and the disinvestment by the city government, by the housing authority in a community like this. And I think that's a big part of it. People aren't looking at how society here has forgotten about this community. You know, basically treated this community like it doesn't exist. And so, but the police, when they're here, they know that America's hardly going to be looking, and they can get a lot away with a lot of stuff. But that's changing right now.
Changing right now. That was Saturday. Now we have a state of emergency, the National Guard out, and who knows how this will go. Dave in Nashville, Tennessee, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. First, my condolences to you and your family. Continue. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I want to speak from the perspective of a black male. Having grown up here in the South, I'm in Nashville, Tennessee now. I grew up in Huntsville, Alabama.
Yes.
What I see continues, and not on a day-to-day basis. Let me be clear on that. It's not a day-to-day basis.
Mm-hmm.
But the sentiments being felt, the anti-police sentiment, is born of frustration. It is a very real phenomenon. It is very, I will say that it's not so prevalent here in Nashville, Tennessee, but in Alabama, it's absolutely prevalent. You can see it everywhere you look, someone has a story. My own brother has had his own situations with the police force there, and it continuously happens. So the sentiments and the anger is real, but that is no justification for what we saw yesterday. I want to ask Pastor Bryant when he was on with you earlier.
Yeah.
Is there a way that there can be there needs to be a line of demarcation between those who are in true and justify protest and those who are there simply to create anarchy? By that, I mean there needs to be a two-pronged attack, a two-pronged approach to this. Being black does not mean that we misuse and abuse the English language. Being black does not mean that we dress in a confrontational and a disrespectful manner to both ourselves and to the general public. We have to fight the battle while realizing that it's an image war at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And we lose that image war when we have images broadcast across the world the way they were yesterday. People close their minds to the reality of the situation. They see things in a black and white, and it's not so much a nuanced approach. When they look on television, they see violence in the streets and fires and people cutting fire hoses and abusing police officers. There has to be a way that we go about this that is both respectful to ourselves, respectful to the cause, and at the same time demands justice. Because while we need justice, we are only going to get it in one way in this day and age, and that is through continuous and direct and positive influence, not only on the youth, but on the systems which we are trying to change.
Hey, Dave, stick with me for a minute. You're terrific, and I want to put it to Natasha Pratt-Harris. Natasha, on Twitter yesterday, I saw somebody put up an image it was two photos side by side, and one side was Martin Luther King Jr., marching, I believe it was in Montgomery or Selma, a lot of people dressed to the nines, but out there in the streets with flags that didn't protect them from police violence then, but it had this image of a unified, coherent movement for change. And the other panel was, you know, there was smoke and maybe some tear gas in a burning car, and people just huddled outside a liquor store being looted. And it said, you know, here's a real movement for change versus just a mess. And now Dave is saying something like this. We've got to, you know, we, i.e. African-Americans, he's saying, have to sort of have their image together at the same time they push for change. Does the Martin Luther King path still work after all these years, Natasha?
Well, one thing I want to say is that every movement, within every movement, there is some moments of messiness. There's no perfection in any movement. So even during that era, there were times when there were riots. We just mentioned in 1968,
yep, sure were.
There were riots in Baltimore. In fact, the sequence of events that occurred overnight are similar to what happened in 1968 in terms of what burned down when and mm-hmm. when people started looting where. So we can't expect or actually assume that there was perfection during Martin's era. The other piece is that our expectations are based on our own perspectives, based upon our own way of life, based upon what our personal experiences have been. And I will say that, number one, I applaud the efforts of those police officers, citizens, and the like who are doing the right thing by each other and by the people. But at the end of the day, when we have children who are coming from varying economic conditions that don't look like my own, for example, don't look like the experiences my own children are having, our expectations are too high. I don't expect a child who comes from the Baltimore City public school system, where they've closed down schools, where they've closed down rec centers, where there is a culture of violence, where there are parents who are on drugs, where there are parents who are deceased, where there are parents who have been disproportionately incarcerated. I don't expect those children to respond in a peaceful, nonviolent, dressed perfectly manner. They're going to come as they are. And similarly, what we see with our police officers, they're actually coming as they are as well. They apparently, the ones who are the bad seeds of our agencies, because not all of them are bad, they're actually coming as they are. They're showing us the worst of the worst in our agencies. The expectations that we have of these children who are going to make mistakes, who will respond passionately and in some cases violently, we must make certain that those expectations are just as significant or just as acknowledged as the expectations we must have of men and women who are hired to protect and serve. They are not hired to abuse and neglect. And that's what's been happening in the city of Baltimore. So what the world has gotten a chance to see is our reality. It's on tape for the first time. My generation talked about this. We experienced this. My husband is a victim of police brutality, but it was not caught on tape. Mm-hmm. The world is seeing it now. This is our reality.
Natasha Pratt-Harris. Dave in Nashville, do you think Martin Luther King's protest fashion still works? Nonviolent protests, a lot of it in the streets, nonviolent. Does that work in 2015?
Well, first of all, going back to address what she just spoke about, I agree wholeheartedly with that in regards to children. But watching television for 4 hours yesterday, I saw quite a few adults. I saw quite a few people dressed in ties or who seemed to be milling about and not influencing, not speaking with, not engaging these children as I think that they should have. When you say does nonviolence, does it still work? Well, the antithesis of that is violence, and violence will never work. I mean, if we were to say, well, nonviolence means don't work, we can only pray that nonviolence has to work because there is no other choice. If you were to resort to violence, then there would be overwhelming forces we see it being deployed today to crush that out, and then grandmother said the PR war would be lost immediately. So it has become very apparent that the things that we have marched for, that Martin Luther King has marched for, that those have not come about to the extent and degree that we all would wish for. But we must continue striving in a way so that we not only win more hearts and minds to our cause, that we also maintain the moral high ground at all times. We must always have the moral high ground.
Dave in Nashville, I got to let you go right there. Son of Alabama, it's really great to talk with you. Thank you for calling, Dave. Lots of feedback here on Facebook. What Greg says, should we really be surprised that a group of people who have been historically disenfranchised and with increasingly bleak futures act out recklessly without fear of punishment? ? And that one lingers. Doug says, police are bringing this on themselves. Oh, he says, we have a violent, poorly trained, poorly recruited, poorly supervised officers going up against an increasingly disenfranchised society. This is predictable chemistry. I'm not sure about the first half of that entirely, but the last half, if you've got disenfranchisement, there can be predictable chemistry. Ray in Milwaukee. Ray, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I'm calling you from the most segregated city in the United States, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And last year at this time, we had a African-American man with mental illness shot 14 times, and it took our police 8 months to name names. And we're going to see this across the country. This is pure rage, pure and simple rage.
You fear it in Milwaukee, what we're seeing now in Baltimore?
Yes, I do. It's coming. I could smell it in the air.
Let's hope not. I mean, after Charleston, when there was such a strong and fast response, I think people were thinking more down the reform path, that we were going to address these problems with policing and turn them around. Let us hope not. But I appreciate your call, Ray. Natasha, here's on Facebook, Carlotta writes, I live in Ferguson, Missouri. And she says it's like deja vu all over again. She writes, I think the same outside agitators have arrived in Baltimore that set fire to Ferguson.
I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it. I mean, when we had the tsunami, when there was a tsunami in 2004, you know, there were predators, child sex predators who came from internationally to prey on children. Anytime you have any natural disaster, any disaster that we're experiencing today, you'll have outside predators. But ultimately, what we must address, though, is our truth. And our truth is that our children are, without a doubt, in pain. Our children are the generation of children who saw a Trayvon Martin murderer not go to jail initially, get acquitted. Our children saw Tremere Rice shot within seconds of police approaching him. Our children see video of Eric Garner being choked, strangled to death. Our children are connected in this city with the story of Freddie, and actually they feel and they know that nothing's going to happen. So, you know, they're outside agitators, yes. There's always opportunists, yes. But at the end of the day, either children who are impacted, who are from this area, or those who decided to come in and engage, at the end of the day, they all have the same reality in terms of those images, in terms of those real stories. And they also ultimately have members of the community who should engage with them, who are choosing not to engage with them, and calling them names. And that's what's happening.
Where do you see the hope here? Do you see in, we just got half a minute, in the mayor, in the police department, in the state government, organizations, people ready to stand up and say, here's the way out of this. Here's the reform. Here's the way.
Well, just yesterday with the announcement, that I got the press release, too, that we had imminent threat from known gang members. There was a young man on social networking named Orlando Gilliard who shared a video saying that I'm a person who organized the peaceful marches on Saturday. We are not attempting to threaten our law enforcement. That is not our agenda. That is not what we're going to do. I actually see what we've always known. The people who are in the trenches, who have the lived experience, who, for example, this man has spent time in prison, they are the ones who are going to make the difference. Some of us are critiquing the idea that these men can become our leaders. They have to become our leaders because they can understand and identify with the children who've been impacted by these events.
Natasha Pratt-Harris, criminal justice and sociology professor at Morgan State University in Baltimore. You're so good to be with us. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
I want to sit back a little and just remember the voice 50 years ago of Martin Luther King. We'll hear just a little bit of that in a moment. Martin Luther King Jr., 50 years later, this is On Point. It may be a good time to remember. After finishing the Selma to Montgomery March, Martin Luther King Jr. delivered a speech on the steps of Alabama's State Capitol building 50 years ago. King called for hope and patience in the fight for civil rights, but it wasn't milk toast. Here's an excerpt.
I know you're asking today, how long will it take? Somebody's asking, how long will prejudice blind the visions of men? I come to say to you this afternoon, however difficult the moment,
yes, sir,
however frustrating the hour, it will not be long,
no, sir,
because truth crushed earth will rise again.
Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
Yes, sir.
Because no lie can live forever.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
How long? Not long.
How long? Yes,
because you shall reap what you sow.
Yes, sir.
How long?
How
not long.
How long?
True forever on the scaffold, wrong forever on the throne.
Yes, sir.
Yet that scaffold sways the future.
Yes.
Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. How long? Not long. Because the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice.
Yes, sir.
How long?
Not long. Not long.
Because mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Yes, sir.
He's trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. He's loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword.
Yes, sir.
His truth is marching on.
Yes, sir.
He has sounded forth the trumpet that shall never call retreat.
Peace.
He is sifting out the hearts of men before his judgment seat.
Yes.
Oh, be swift, my soul, to answer him. Be jubilant, my feet. Our God is marching on.
Yes.
Glory, hallelujah.
Yes,
glory, hallelujah.
Yes,
Martin Luther King, Jr., there, Montgomery, Alabama, March 25th, 1965. How long? Not long. Well, 50 years now. Our thanks in this hour to Erica Green with the Baltimore Sun for joining us, covering everything that's going on right now in Baltimore, to Baltimore City Councilman Carl Stokes, to Pastor Jamal Bryant, who was with us, the minister who gave the eulogy yesterday in Baltimore for Freddie Gray. To all of you for your calls, your many interesting thoughts online. We're at onpointradio.org. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. Thank you for being with us. This is On Point.